So what I wanted to share with you, and it kind of comes out of, out of whatever, years of practice, but I started off in Tibetan tradition almost 40 years ago, and it interlaced the whole time. I've kind of been doing both. I went, went to Thailand a few years after starting off in Tibetan tradition, but both have been part of my lives, and there's some illuminating aspects to this whole question of not self and where it goes. So I want to, I think it actually can be useful, which would be the whole point of doing it, or else I wouldn't bother. So let me start out in the four foundations of mindfulness, which is where the Buddha taught how to do meditation. He tells us to be mindful internally and externally. Mindful internally and externally. So when we turn our mindfulness to the external, we start to see some significant things. We notice that just like every aspect of ourselves, as we've been talking about, is in constant motion, constant web of cause and effect, so is the case with everything else around us. So is the case. Everything else is in motion. We're not static. That's the profound truth of anatta, which my wonderful colleagues have been exploring. But when we turn it outward, this raises a real profound question, because it's the facts of impermanence and dependent arising bring us to seeing not self or the lack of inherent existence of self. And if all other phenomena are also impermanent and arising from prior causes, do other phenomena have any inherent self either? Everything. Does it have any inherent self? So, to put this another way, if a crucial breakthrough of realization Theravada tradition is a lack of inherent existence of personal selfhood, thus anatta, is there something similar for all phenomena, and what are the implications of that on the path? And this lack of inherent existence of everything is usually called emptiness in English Dharma translations. Sunyata is often used in Sanskrit. It's a Sanskrit word often used in Mahayana traditions. And some of you know there's basically two major cords of Buddha Dharma. It's oversimplifying, but Theravada is what we're kind of in our tradition here, but there's also Mahayana, which is all across northern Asia, with a lot of interlacing. And the broader view of emptiness certainly is emphasized in Mahayana tradition. But it's true the Buddha taught on emptiness. That's right in the Lesser Discourse on Emptiness, Majjhima Nikaya 121. The Buddha taught about emptiness. So it's not like there's some exclusivity or separation here. There is a matter of emphasis, perhaps, because it's developed. Emptiness is developed in Mahayana. And I found it really feeds back into helping me understand anatta, and the two are incredibly complementary. So it kind of brings useful understanding to what we've been talking about. And the heart of understanding, of realizing emptiness, is taking these understandings we've been exploring about anatta and just applying them to everything. Because studying the five aggregates, which Lindell talked about, the five khandhas in Pali, we realize that our sense of self is like a patchwork or an interplay or a mosaic of all these five interacting. There's no inherent ultimate self there, but there's this whole stream of interlacing, interacting factors from which we posit a self, and then we walk around in this self. But it's the same with any external object, like an automobile. It's an interaction of parts accumulating over time, and there's a mental designation that's an automobile. Just 3 weeks ago, we have a tiny little Chevy Sonic hatchback parked over there. I was rear-ended by an 18-wheeler, and still here. The truck, it locked its brakes on a slippery, when it rains in the Northwest after it has been dry and there's oil on the road, and if you know about that, you're careful with your brakes. This guy didn't know about that. So he locked his brakes, and I could see, I'm sitting at a stoplight, and this giant truck is just sliding down the hill towards me, and he rammed it in the back of our car. Nobody hurt. The dented rear hatch even still worked, but somehow insurance fixed it, which included replacing another hatch from another Sonic. So in the middle of all this, there was a teaching on emptiness around the nature of car, because I've had a sense of our car, this little red. But what if the truck had hit it harder and broken it up so it no longer drove? Would it still be a car? Or would it be a wreck? Or what if it was chopped up in a wrecking yard, a bunch of parts? Would that? When does it stop being a car and start being a pile of scrap? I mean, I was really like, you know, it's interesting thinking about this. And then the repair process, it was some evening, they tore the thing apart, and it wasn't drivable. So was it no longer a car? Or what was it? It has no inherent car existence. It's just labeling according to how it works. And now it's back, but it is sort of like, you know, when people have like a transplanted heart and then they remember memories from the other person, that kind of thing. So now the hatchback has some other hatchback's rear lid. So I don't know if it's my car anymore. It's like, but who's that? I think about the journey that hatchback and people lifted it, and did they get mad at each other? And I don't know what, you know, so it's not the same car. It even put a little glitzy Chevy emblem on it, so it's got a little kind of bling it never had before. So I don't even know if it's the same car. It's not the same car. And actually, ultimately, there wasn't any car ultimately anyway. But it just kind of, and everything's like that. Everything's like that. So the more we bring the world of physical objects and other phenomena into our mindfulness, just like we're doing in our practice, the more our sense of their inherent existence falls apart, just like it does with our personhood. We see that things accumulate over time, that each thing is a gathering of component parts. This gathering of parts, we give it an identification, a name, conceptual designation. This kind of stuff's often called reifying in Mahayana talk, to reify something. And it's completely parallel to our understanding of anatta. The more we come aware of the interaction of parts making up ourself, the more we're freed from an attachment to this self that we posit onto the interaction. Doesn't mean I'm not Steve, but ultimately, there's no Steve there. So where, you know, looking externally again, where's the car? The designation falls apart. We realize it's just a bunch of parts moving together in time. There's no car essence. And we start to look across all phenomena. And that gets pretty amazing. What about our body parts? Getting a little more personal. And this is sort of like the overlap, because to be sure, in terms of the Satipatthana Sutta, we look at body first. So we're sort of looking internally in a way. And at the same time, this is kind of externally also, so it's kind of a transition point. What if a body part changes so it won't do what it used to do? Which, as those of you who are getting older may have encountered this, I don't know, maybe, just maybe. And some of y'all who are young too, right? My dad, my father, he lost much of his left leg in World War II. And was that which remained still a leg? It didn't do leg things anymore. Maybe he was a stump, you know? He struggled with that. What was it? What was that? And what did it mean? And was that my leg, or my leg is gone, or all that identification? Pretty powerful. So in the four foundations of mindfulness, a key part is the refrain, where the Buddha said 13 times how this practice works, which relates internally and externally. He said, and one abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. So simple, right? So beguilingly simple. One abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. So as we touched on in the beginning, the Buddha suggested we cultivate mindfulness internally and externally. And our normal Theravada path is mostly internal. You know, we sit and practice, and all the stuff's going on. We're thinking stuff, we're feeling stuff. It's kind of an internal exploration to a large degree, which is great. And it's really, really effective. We, four foundations, body, Vedanas, mind states, and mind objects. It's kind of the galaxy, what the Buddha pointed us to. It's all essentially internal. From that, we realize their impermanence. We realize there's no inherent self to any of them. We realize anatta. There's freedom there. But when we turn our mindfulness externally, as the Buddha suggested, we increasingly see that it's not self. This emptiness of all phenomena. No thing has inherent existence. There is no car there. There's no leg there. Ultimately, conventionally, yep, ultimately not. There's just a rising and falling of interdependent phenomena. And as we, you know, seek to walk the earth, to live life in a freedom and the freedom that the Buddha taught, this realization of emptiness, of everything, internal and external, can make a huge difference. It can really shift how we see things. You know, consider something we might be attracted to externally or even obsessed with. Could be a red Ferrari, could be a person of some preferred gender, could be a new title at our place of employment, all these external things. And I've learned over time to, in practice, to not only be mindful internally, but externally at that relationship. It can cut through that obsession in very powerful ways. Ultimately, we learn there's nothing to attach to and nobody to do the attaching. It kind of cuts it both ways. There's nothing to attach to and there's nobody to do the attaching. And this embracing of emptiness cuts through clinging by illuminating the emptiness, the lack of inherent existence of anything we might attach to and any self that might be attaching. It's kind of, it comes apart from both sides. To me, it's a whole nother layer of power. Exactly what the Buddha taught, and it's not separate from Theravada or anything. It's kind of a different emphasis, perhaps. That's okay. It's all good. Different emphasis. And there's a way in which this broadening to include the lack of inherent existence of self and others opens us into compassion, which is really, I think I'm sort of going to walk through a couple places that this leads us to. It opens us into vast compassion because it dismantles further the illusion of self and object, of self and other, the duality of self and other. So everything falls away, all the separations about me and other, and we realize we're kind of in the same boat together. You know, there's no other there. And from this, we can automatically wish for the best for everyone, that they be freed of suffering in particular, that they be freed from entrapment in dukkha, which is, at its essence, clinging. So we wish that others can be free of that. That's really the problem. Pain happens. Dukkha, we can change that. That's what the path is about. So anatta, of course, goes in a similar direction. I mean, it's the same direction. Clarifies there's no distinction between this person and that person, this self and that self. Compassion arises. But Mahayana takes a step, I suggest, into great compassion because it extends out into all phenomena. It's one of the beautiful things about Mahayana that I love, and it's an aspect. Joseph Goldstein has explored this a lot. He's pretty amazing about it. He talks about bodhicitta a lot. Bodhisattva ideal in his teachings, and I've talked to him a little bit, and he's done a whole self-retreat studying the writings of Dugo Kinsei Rinpoche, one of the great 20th century Tibetan masters. So it's for quite a number of teachers in our tradition, there's a whole lot of interplay. Guy Armstrong's like that too. So to awaken for the sake of all sentient beings is really interconnected with this whole sense of the emptiness of everything. And it's a core Mahayana practice to vow on a daily basis to awaken for the sake of all sentient beings. And this isn't a black and white difference, because I've had the great honor of being around, I was on pilgrimage last fall in Thailand, and was around some great Thai masters, some of whom were arhats. Fully realized that was, they were incredible disciples of Ajahn Chah, still alive, but Ajahn Ganha in particular just kind of blew me away because he just radiated so much love at everybody. It was just so crazily unconditional and amazing. There were a couple of Americans, he was making fun of the Americans all the time and stuff, but he did it in this incredibly lifting way. So I say this because I want to get into any kind of exclusivity or hierarchy or something's better or whatever. But that said, you know, some of the great Tibetan masters, and that's a Mahayana tradition, I know the best, are so extraordinary in their dedication for the awakening of all sentient beings. It's just a glowing sense of the potential from the smallest gnat to the most difficult dictator. And it's coupled with a sense that the emptiness of all phenomena, internal and external, is interlaced with consciousness. And this is powerful stuff, that the emptiness of all phenomena and this awareness that we're resting in, they're interconnected. It's not like they're separate from this point of view. The Atamasaka Sutra, a Mahayana text, not Tibetan, I think it's Chinese, but it says, the Bodhisattva's actions are boundless because the nature of all things is boundless. So there's an interconnection there. You know, if everything is empty, everything is boundless, and therefore we have that relationship, and let's see where this goes. There's a sense within Mahayana Buddhism, in particular the Nyingma tradition, that while every single aspect of the universe is empty of inherent existence, it's simultaneously radiant with ultimate awareness, with awareness. I don't want to concretize around ultimate. But there's awareness and there's emptiness. How interesting is that? From this understanding, emptiness and awareness they're co-emergent, meaning they depend on, are based on each other. Just watching the clock here. Oh yeah, I'm good. Okay. So I'm almost done. So in your own meditation practice, have you ever become just aware of awareness? You know, sometimes we do, aware of awareness. We like settle down through all the layers of aware of this and aware of that and oh, this thought and this feeling. And at some point, they're kind of gone and all that's left is awareness. It's like, oh, and it's not me aware, it's just awareness. That's pretty amazing. But we can't find it. You ever try to find awareness? Like, where is it? You can't find it. It's not in your head, it's not in your knee, it's not a thing. You can't find it. It just is. It is awareness. And we gradually realize that there is awareness. It's not me, it's not self, and it is. And if all phenomena are empty, and awareness just is, this kind of suggests that there's like, you don't go any farther than that. There's emptiness of all phenomena, there's all awareness. Somehow, they're co-emergent. Somehow, they arise from each other. Over my pay grade, to realize that, but that is what these teachings point us toward. It's pretty amazing. I mean, there's this emptiness of all phenomena. There's no concrete anything anywhere. And somehow, in the middle of it all, there's awareness happening. That's pretty amazing. How does that work? What does that mean about the nature of the universe? Is it somehow pervaded by empty awareness, somehow transcending our personhood? Many of the great masters say something just like that. Here's a little quote from the Longchenpa, great 14th century Tibetan master. He said, "The essence of awareness is empty. Its nature is luminous. Its expression is unceasing. Experience is neither mind nor anything but mind. It is a vivid display of emptiness like magical illusion in the very moment, inconceivable and unutterable. All experience arising in the mind, at its inception, know it as emptiness." So that's one of the great master Longchenpa, 14th century Nyingma master. When Tibetan people, they always refer to him as the omniscient Longchenpa. He was just unbelievably extraordinary. So he has massive creds to me. So how amazing when you think of this awareness, empty of inherent existence, empty of selfhood, yet somehow universal in all sentient beings. And that really helps in our practice, you know, when we're kind of letting, because it's scary, when our sense of selfhood falls apart sometimes, you can feel like your toes are off the edge of a cliff, like, whoa, what happened to Steve? But at the same time, there's awareness there, something continuing, maybe not permanent, but continuing, they're different things. Permanent, we instantly concretize it and we make, you know, that's where God's come from. But it's not that. There's something continuing. So just dance with that, you know, in your practice. This interweaving of empty nature of all phenomena and the empty luminous nature of awareness, and see where that takes you. And maybe that means that all beings can awaken. Even the most difficult person that you just absolutely find their actions horrendous, they can awaken. So we got to think about them differently. That's where great compassion comes from. There are no enemies. There is no other. No matter what they do, they're just like us. They can awaken, just like us. All beings are empty and also radiantly aware, at least beneath their conditioning. And there's a great line from the numerical discourses of the Buddha, the numerical discourses, so it's right from the Buddha, where he says, the mind is clear, luminous, obscured by visiting defilements. That's right there in the Pali Canon. You know, and so that's pretty amazing. Saying almost the same thing. The mind is clear, luminous, obscured by visiting defilements. And I find that really helpful, you know. All of our stuff, it's just a visiting defilement, folks. You know, whatever your thing is, whatever your hang-up is, whatever your trauma is, it's a visiting defilement, end of story. And that's obscuring this luminous nature. So the more we cop to that, the more this unpeeling, this unfolding that happens in practice seems perfectly natural. It's just visiting defilements, falling away, and we become mindful of them, and we go, oh yeah, you again. And that slowly kind of, in the suttas, there's all these stories about Mara is the sort of personification of a deity that's trying to confuse the Buddha and prevent him from being awakened, and never goes away. And Mara will come in these incredibly devious ways and try to trick the Buddha. And he totally gets it. You know, it's like, I see you, Mara. And then Mara slumps and kind of slumps away. His shoulders sag and he slumps away. It's pretty funny. So it's kind of like that, you know. He's talking about making friends with your stuff, you know. It's like, but to know that underlying it is this great luminosity. To me, that's one of the things that the Mahayana, and it says it right there in the suttas, the Mahayana brings in that helps us steer through the complexities of life itself with more of a sense of possibility, of upliftment, of universality, of radiance. Because sometimes, that's part of why I'm a little bit Mahayana, sometimes our mindfulness practice can get kind of dry. For some of us, some of the time, you know, it doesn't mean it is, it means our experience of it is at that moment, and loving kindness really helps, but also recognizing this radiance really helps. So all phenomena are empty, and awareness is empty. And in closing, in the spirit of compassion, of the compassion that emptiness illuminates, there's this, does anybody know who Shantideva is? A few nods. Shantideva was a great, great Indian pundit from the 8th century, wrote this incredible Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. The chapter on patience, from any of you ever having problems with people you love, I would recommend it. It's incredibly contemporary and useful, Shantideva. And the Dalai Lama often finishes teachings, and I humbly follow in his footsteps with this quote, where he says, as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, so too may I remain to dispel the miseries of the world. So that is the bodhisattva intent, to dispel the miseries of the world, but done from a place of recognizing this. It's not a burden. It's like a, you know, it's a natural convergence of our potential for awakening overlaid only by conditioning and illuminated by emptiness.